The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis. We've got the best of the Book Nook coming your way following NPR News, and today we're going to look back in an interview I did in 1998 with the terrible plane crash at LaGuardia this week. I wanted to revisit an interview with a guy who knows as much about flying as just about anybody. Longtime pilot for the military and commercial, his name is John J. Nance, and we talked many years ago about airlines and his best-selling books. That's coming up on the Best of the Book Nook. Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and this is the first show I've done in our new studios at WYSO. And I'm absolutely thrilled to be here, and I hope you are too, because you're here with me at this very moment, listening to a program that comes your way every Saturday morning at 7 o'clock. And on Sunday mornings, we bring you a totally different program at 10:30. And we're going back into our archive for this one. I've been thinking a lot about airline travel this week. With the massive lines at airports, trying to get through the security. Back in 1998, I interviewed a guy who knows a lot about flying. A longtime pilot who was also a best-selling author. His resume is fairly amazing. John J. Nance. In 1998, I interviewed him for his novel, The Last Hostage. And remember, in 1998, there was no Department of Homeland Security. There was no TSA. There was no Patriot Act. You remember those carefree days? Well, there was airline deregulation, which did cause a lot of problems, but nothing like today. With these massive lines, with ICE being called into airports to try to help the TSA, and with air traffic controllers under tremendous pressure, that might have been an air traffic control problem that caused that terrible accident at LaGuardia this week. Let's listen now to John J. Nance as we talked about flying back in 1998, what it was like, and you'll be thinking, well, is it better now or not? Here we are. On the Best of the Book Nook.
Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook. It's my pleasure to welcome John J. Nance. His new book is The Last Hostage. Many of you are familiar with his previous works. John is the aviation analyst for the ABC television network, and he's also an aviation editor for Good Morning America. He is also an attorney and a veteran Air Force pilot, as well as a airline captain for a major U.S. carrier, unless this information has changed. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's good to be with you.
How do you find time to do all this stuff?
Oh, you give up a few things, like sleep, you know, but not really. I've always had two or three things going at once, and the most of writing a novel like this, especially doing one a year, is plotting it, and you can do that while you're doing just about anything else. These are ideas that come to you in the shower, they come to you at 2 a.m. in the morning. About 6 months to plot one, about 2 months to write it.
With a book like this, I'm always a little bit leery of giving away more than the author might want us to know so that people aren't discouraged from getting the book, that they don't think, oh, I already know what happened.
Right.
What happens in this one?
In this one, we have a quintessential problem that's a nightmare for commercial aviation. We have an airline, and there are not too many of them anymore, fortunately. We have an airline that's so new and so busy being an upstart and trying to get started. They don't have time for all the refinements, like, for instance, having a stable system for pilots being aware of how their emotional health is. In any other major carrier or minor carrier that's established, this particular airline captain would have been identified as having a major problem a year before. He's coming apart at the seams, this particular fellow who's kind of the hero of my book and yet an anti-hero, because 2 years ago his little girl, an 11-year-old daughter, was murdered. He knows who the murderer is. He's even tried to kill him himself, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. A U.S. attorney fouled up the warrant that fouled up the prosecution and then subsequently lied about it. And here at the end of 2 years, his entire rage is focused on that United States attorney as he walks aboard his airplane one morning, looks in first class, and finds that the very guy who fouled up this prosecution and let this murderer go free is sitting in his first class section. And that's the beginning of the book and the beginning of the action.
My guest is John J. Nance, and the book is The Last Hostage. You've enjoyed a lot of success with your previous books. Would you like to talk about your career as a writer?
Yeah, it actually began with the collapse of my airline, Braniff International, back in 1982 on May 12th. At 4:34 in the afternoon. Not that that's a particular red-letter day in my memory. I was a pilot for them from 1975 forward. When I got out of the Air Force, I went to work for them. I had been writing for years articles, things of that nature, always hoping that someday I could get to the book level. May 13th, after the collapse, I had nothing to lose by trying to find an agent, and it started the process, which led to four nonfiction books, and now so far six major fiction books, and two made for TV movies so far, another one in the works, and a lot of success, as you pointed out. The transition between nonfiction and fiction was about 1990, and that was as a result of a fellow by the name of Jim Wade, who at the time worked for Crown Publishing when they were independent, who thought it might be interesting for me to do a book about a fictional crash and to show how the National Transportation Safety Board worked. By the time I got the outline written, he said, this is a major novel, and that really got me launched.
John, as a pilot, you obviously have some unique insights that the rest of us don't have as far as the way that these planes fly all over the country. Mm-hmm. I'm tremendously impressed every day that we don't hear about more crashes. We just heard on the news about the crash in Taiwan.
That's right.
With the deregulation of the airline industry, do you feel that our skies are less safe than they once were?
Well, let's put it this way. First of all, we have to proceed from the reality that every day we have literally thousands of airplanes up and down and nothing ever goes wrong. I mean, it's almost 100% safe. It's so close, it's ridiculous. The reason that people sell insurance in airports for flights is because there's almost zero risk. By the same token, we're all raving paranoids in aviation because we know that's what it takes to keep it that safe. And we know that one blink in the wrong direction, one mistake, and you can end up starting a chain reaction that ends up with an accident. Now, having said all that, the mid-80s, we came close to a Holocaust because by deregulating this industry, which was a ridiculously overdone act, we needed some form of it. We didn't need to throw the baby in the bathwater out and let airlines become anything they wanted to become. What we ended up doing was putting cost pressure in an area that should never have been experienced or should never have had that experience, and that is on maintenance and training. We had airlines fighting for survival and cutting and slashing their budgets in the mid-80s. We had upstart carriers that should never have been allowed in as airlines, and we have a few vestiges of that today. ValueJet is a perfect example of the type of airline that never, ever should have been allowed to become one because all they did was come in to make money. They did not come in to establish a carrier. Most of that is gone. Most of that type of carrier is gone, and we have a good, stable industry that now, of course, has gone into what we call an oligopoly. They have formed their fortress hubs in different places. They've raised their prices wherever they could. They robbed Peter to pay for Paul's ticket, and we end up with a situation where if you want to get an advance purchase, you can do it for about $250, but if you happen to walk up to the counter at the last minute, you get socked for about $1,800. For some of these flights. Ridiculous ranges of affairs. That's really another story, but it does show you that where stability occurs, safety gets better, and that's where we've been for the last number of years. We have an extremely safe system because it's a very stable system. It isn't a very responsive one, and certainly service, airline service, is now an oxymoron.
You are listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Going back to 1998, John J. Nance talking about his bestseller, The Last Hostage. And did you hear what he just said? In 1998, he said, airline service is now an oxymoron. Whoa. Well, it's certainly not any better now. Whoa. Can you imagine waiting 5 hours in line just to get through airport security? Some people are doing that. Some people are missing their flights right now. Airline service has gotten very complicated. We'll continue with the Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, fact-based journalism in service of democracy, right after this. The best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO, going back to 1998, when I was visited in studio by an author who was a pilot, a best-selling writer, and just a real expert on aviation. And we talked a lot about airlines, about flying, about military flight. And I looked him up on Google to see, first of all, whether he's still living. He is. He published his first book in 1990, and his last book came out in 2017. So I'm guessing he's retired from writing. Let's listen now to more of the best of the Book Nook.
My guest is John J. Nance, and he's written a new book. It's called The Last Hostage. I have fond memories of flying on Braniff out of Des Moines. One of my best friends worked for the airline. Mm-hmm. It seems like a lot of airlines have really suffered in the years since deregulation. We look at what happened to TWA. We're looking at these mergers recently, Continental and Northwest, which really scared me half to death when I heard about that. But as we look at the airlines getting bigger and bigger and bigger, do you see that service will continue to decline?
What's going to happen is we're going to end up with multinational corporations responsive to no particular country, owning huge airline corporations that span the globe. Some might argue that that's better. Certainly for Americans working in the airline industry, it won't be better. But overall, I suppose this is inevitable. The main problem is simply this. We had a special nature to aviation, and we practiced it better, I think, than any other country in the world here in the United States, and probably Canada as well can jump on that bandwagon. I don't mean just in terms of safety, but I mean in terms of comfort. Now we are buses with wings, compared to what the international carriers do on international routes. And some can argue that, okay, it's fine because we've taught a whole generation, two generations of Americans to fly, but the reality is that if we hadn't gone down that road, we still would have as many people flying today, we would have much more stable fares, we would have some of those old-line carriers would still be here, we would have gone through a lot less heck, and we would have not run out of the aviation industry literally tens of thousands of years of airline human experience, which is gone forever. It's been a very sad saga, but I think it'll take 20 or 30 years before historians can get rid of the bias and look back and see what ridiculousness this period involved and what demagoguery was involved on the political level, both Democrat and Republican, and say, no, deregulation is great. Well, it's never been great. It's one of the most unmitigated disasters ever visited on ourselves by an act of the American government.
I must say I found some irony in the fact that they're renaming that airport in Washington after President Reagan with his strong role in the deregulation, particularly when we look at what happened to the air traffic controllers and their strike. Are air traffic controllers recovering after all these years from what happened?
Well, yeah, I do have to put on my lawyer hat, though, and say that the one thing, I've had arguments with people like Carl Stern of NBC on and others about this, but yes, the president had the opportunity back there to define when a job action became illegal by saying that after a certain number of hours off the job, it becomes an illegal job action as described in that particular law. But the controllers really fired themselves because the statute was very clear. If they engaged in an illegal job action, they were were terminated, not by the act of the president. And that kind of gets lost. So Reagan set it up, but he didn't really fire the controllers. They fired themselves. Now, we lost a lot of good people in that. There's no question. A lot of folks got caught up in it, caught up in the rhetoric. Many of them are now back. Well, I say many of them. Some of them are back. Many of them were out forever. Many of them around the world working under contract in other places. We've rebuilt the force. What happened that was beneficial was that we immediately upgraded the air traffic control methodologies from ones in which people were launched into the air helter-skelter and allowed to hold at destination, which was very wasteful and raised the risk, quite frankly, to have all these airplanes wheeling around in the sky. And we changed to a system in which you weren't allowed to leave the gate until we had a slot for you in air traffic control to flow all the way to your destination without hold times. So holding became a tool used only as a last resort. It has massively altered the level of efficiency and safety of the system. And I think that was one of the prime benefits. Are we as safe today? We're safer. One reason is a thing that has nothing to do with air traffic control. It's called TCAS. Traffic Collision Avoidance System, which is on board our airplanes. Unfortunately, the FAA did not involve the controllers in this, which is really an act of infamy. Two airplanes coming somewhat at each other, these two TCAS boxes will talk to each other electronically, tell one pilot to climb, another to descend. They won't tell the poor controller anything until the pilot says, hey, we're responding to a resolution alert, and the controller has to sit back and just watch it happen, clear other traffic out of the way, and then try to repair his picture. That's not good. Otherwise, though, we have really come a long way.
My guest is John J. Nance, and his new book is The Last Hostage. John, your book, most of the action takes place over the Rocky Mountains, over the Colorado area. Mm-hmm. The flight is supposed to be going from Colorado to Phoenix.
Right.
And
that was the initial idea.
Right. At the beginning of the book, the plane has some problems, some technical problems. And as they're talking about landing it somewhere else, the economic issue comes forth. The airline in this particular case, an imaginary airline, a small startup airline, they're very upset back at their hub or wherever the plane took off from.
Right.
Because they have certain protocols they wish to be followed, which don't have a whole lot to do with anything more than economics.
That's true. That's true. And this really does reflect life the way it's lived in the aviation business. Now, this is not to say that a big carrier like United, Delta, American would never have economic considerations about where an airplane should go to if they have, for instance, an engine shutdown in flight. But what it does say is that the smaller carriers are going to be able to act on that with greater aggression. In other words, a captain of a smaller carrier who doesn't have a lot of money is going to know that he's going to get criticized or frowned at least, or maybe even sanctioned if he goes into the wrong place, even though safety dictates that he probably should do it that way. Decisions get made, unfortunately, by air crew members who want their companies to survive. And that's why when you're running an airline, one of the things that's the toughest thing to do when it's a small airline is you've got to set an atmosphere of total compliance with safety above all else, including money. You've got a fiduciary obligation there that some of these mom-and-pop organizations that came in, or like ValueJet, a bunch of corporate guys who came in just to make money, they not only don't understand this, they have zero respect for it. And consequently, you have decisions made totally on economics. Aviation was not built to the level of safety that we enjoy today by people who were concentrating solely on economics. The economics have to be there, but so does that prime directive that no matter what else, we got to keep it safe. And that means that sometimes we do the most inefficient thing from a monetary point of view.
You're giving me the impression that ValueJet accepted those dangerous items onto that one flight for an economic motive.
First of all, there's never a single cause to an airline accident. If ValueJet had been structured with the same degree of care as a real airline, because I never considered them a real airline, there would have been a systemic structure around them that would have found a way to stop that egregious act from occurring. There would have been people to watch the shipment. There would have been been a supervisor who might have wandered by at the right moment. It's like putting an arrow through Swiss cheese without hitting the cheese. Very seldom do all the little holes line up if you've got 15 layers. But if you only got one piece of Swiss cheese, it's going to be easy to go right through a hole. And that's what happened. An airline like that, quote unquote, had only one layer of Swiss cheese there to prevent an accident or an incident, and there were holes all through it. And it was very easy for Sabrejet, the company that I think that's the correct name, but the maintenance company, to make a mistake like this and to not have it caught. Whenever we look at an airline accident, including the one that occurred just today in Taipei, we never find one cause. There never is a cause. There's always a multiplicity of things, and it's always a systemic structure. Something in the system allowed an atmosphere to occur that was more conducive to an accident or more conducive to an accident chain. And when people come in and try to solve just one problem, they miss the whole point. As an Air Force veteran, I can tell you that's the way we still do it. You know, if a guy fouls up and lands gear up, why, we take his wings away, throw him out of flying, and we're not going to have the problem again. We don't look at the fact that we have guys getting tired and going up late at night who might make a mistake, that we have a system or maybe a checklist that isn't quite right. Oh, we'll worry about that later. But we get rid of that guy, and you know the funny part is, and I'm really talking about a real story here, it occurred about 20 years ago to a friend of mine who landed a C-5A gear up in Travis Air Force Base. They didn't know they'd landed gear up, by the way, until they opened the door and the ladder went out horizontally. The ridiculous part was, here was the one guy in the United States Air Force least likely to ever land an aircraft gear up again. We had bought that experience. We paid $1 million to train him not to do this again, and we fire him. This makes no sense. And that gets to the heart of the way aviation safety has learned to run. Thanks to the civilian community and the National Transportation Safety Board, we now know you can never look at just one cause, and you can never look at a system and say that there isn't something in that system which has contributed to an accident or an incident.
This morning in the New York Times, there was an obituary of a longtime aviation pioneer. I don't recall his name right offhand. I think he was Canadian, and he was probably in his 90s. And he had described how he had been in numerous crashes, numerous near crashes, many near collisions. You've flown a lot of hours. Have you ever been in a crash?
Fortunately not. But again, I came into aviation at a time in which most of the mechanical problems had been solved. I'm sure this individual went just as my stepfather, who passed away 2 years ago, who had two digits on his private license. They were way back there in the 20s and 30s when aviation was a very gamey proposition. Even in the 40s and 50s, it was very gamey. In the 50s, we had propeller-driven airliners. Out of every four flights, there was a very high probability you were going to shut down at least one engine flying a four-engine bird. No longer is that the case. I've been at this 12,000 hours of flying time. I've flown DC-8s, 747s, 727s, C-141s. I've shut down three engines in my career. And that's about the way jets go these days. I've had a couple of close calls. Close only in terms of I got closer to the edge of the envelope than I ever want to be, but not close in terms of I was out of options and this was my last chance. I've never been that close to the brink, and I never want to be.
Well, we're in quite an aviation area. As you know, the Wright brothers tested out their flying machines in this area extensively. Absolutely. Of course, we have Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, formerly McCook Field, many retired aviation folks in this area. Many folks out there at Wright-Patterson probably listening to you right now. As you look at the military side of things, we seem to have had a lot of military planes going down here recently.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a trend?
Oh, yes, there's a trend. And here's what the trend is. And I speak to you as a 28-year veteran officer and pilot, and one with a 23-year record and a C-141 unblemished, and I'm now on the retired list on the reserves. I know what I'm talking about here. 2.5 years ago, A fellow by the name of Dr. Alan Deal came out in Time Magazine and several other publications as throwing darts at the Air Force safety system. The Air Force did its usual job of trying to discredit the messenger, but they have not succeeded, and this attempt is now coming apart at the seams. Al is a friend of mine. He happened to be absolutely right. We have two major problems in air safety in the United States Air Force, and they are both problems of our own making. First of all, you have to do a professional job of investigating accidents if you're going to be able to learn the lessons and then apply them. We do not, and we have never done professional jobs because we use ourselves, line officers, who have no more than a week at Southern California, University of Southern California on a training course, and usually only a 3-day course, and suddenly get pulled into the position of trying to do the same job that 20 and 30-year veterans, many with PhDs at the National Transportation Safety Board, do. And on top of that, we give them 1 month to solve an accident that may be as complex as a B-1. And God, I hope we never have a B-2, but I mean, these are complex weapon systems. 1 month, the first week for these officers is always in a daze, trying to figure out what to do, reading the manual, staying up about 18, 19 hours a day. The second and the third week, you really kicked in and begin to get something done. The fourth week, you're doing nothing but preparing for the briefing for the general. That's it. So we have about 2 weeks to really investigate accidents and find out all the causes. The same complexity of accidents, it takes the NTSB 1, 2, and sometimes 3 years. This is insane. And on top of that, the second problem is we cheat. We cheat because we let our senior commanders influence, whether they want to admit it or not. My friends out there in uniform know that this is the case. We let ourselves cheat because we don't want certain things leaking into these reports that might embarrass us in the public. And that is not the proper thing for people of integrity to do. The system has to be changed. We are the fox guarding the chicken coop, and it's got to be stopped. And we will never improve as long as we have control in the Air Force of our own accident investigations.
We had a Harrier go down right by the highway here just last year outside Wright Patt, and when you see $1 million just blow up like that, mm-hmm. it makes you concerned as a taxpayer.
Most of the folks in higher command, colonels and generals who are involved in air operations, will immediately come to their feet and snort that, well, now wait a minute, this is a very dangerous operation. I mean, we do dangerous things. Well, guys, sometimes yes. Most of the time, no. When we're fighting peacetime, some of the weapon systems like the F-16, the F-15, which still have multiple redundancies, yes, they're more on the edge and the mission is more on the edge. But we don't authorize people to go down to 50 feet and fly through the dirt and do dangerous things in training any more than we authorize those of us in C-141s or C-17s to go out and do obviously dangerous things when there isn't a real need for it. We can train only to certain levels, and beyond that it becomes counterproductive because we're imperiling people and weapon systems. So when we're fighting peacetime, that argument is usually a bunch of balderdash. And even when we're in wartime, do you know we lost far more people in Desert Storm to training accidents over there than we did to operational accidents? As a matter of fact, I think it's about a 5-to-1 ratio. The Air Force does not really like to talk about this, neither do our brethren in the Navy or the Marines. But the fact is that we hurt ourselves far more in training than we do anywhere else, and it doesn't necessarily have to be so. Some accidents, yes, they probably are avoidable. You pull off the target out in a fighter out on the range in Arizona, and somebody gets disoriented, it's going to happen one out of every X number of times, and you may lose the weapon system. You may lose the guy. But most of the time, we've got rules and regulations and procedures to make training safe and yet productive. And it's when we violate those procedures and then refuse to be honest about what happened because some commander might get his tail in a ringer, that's when we lie. And we lie to the president, we lie to the Congress, and we lie to ourselves. As I say, this is a major, huge, percolating scandal that is about to blow up in the Air Force's face because we had a couple of generals who let the usual cover-ups go on in regard to a C-130 crash up in Portland, a reserve crash last year. Well, it's coming apart at the seams. You've now got a couple of representatives and a couple of senators who are white-hot angry, and the further they pull back that layer, the more they find that what happened is not something a free society can allow. So, you know, stay tuned. I love my service, and I'm very proud of it, but I want it to be one of integrity, and right now we have tripped over the wire in this area.
Well, it is kind of shocking as just a normal John Q. public like myself to hear about this guy who was trying to be a hotshot apparently in Italy and flying under the cable of the cable car. And
we don't know, in all fairness, we do not know the details of what happened on that yet. I would submit to you that if the investigation is conducted by my guys at the Air Force, we will not know what the full story was, because it'll get skewed along the way. But truth be told, there is no reason that I know of for them to be violating that 1,000-foot minimum AGL, that's above ground level, rule, certainly not in that valley. Now, did the guy get lost? Did he have a problem? We don't know the idea there. We don't know. We do know that there had been reports of pilots hot-dogging in that area before, trying to fly under the wires. If that was a part of this, if there was a purposeful violation, then there is no excuse under the sun. None. But here again, it's systemic. It's not just a matter of pulling that crew out, lining them up against a wall in terms of career, you know, and shooting them in career terms, not in actual terms, even though I think there are a lot of Italians who right now are crying for their scalps. It's a matter of looking at the system. How did the atmosphere develop at that particular base that would allow anybody to think that they could do that? And I will tell you, that's very, very rare in military service. Now, I've been a transport guy all my life, not a fighter guy, but yet I know the fighter community. I've dealt in human factors all many, many years. And I can tell you categorically that there was never a scintilla of tolerance in any air operation I've ever been around for hot dogging or buzzing. That was the quickest way to lose your wings forever, not to mention possibly being court-martialed. The Air Force does that right. We just don't have any tolerance for it. So if that occurred, big if, then what happened at that base that would permit a slide from normal operations of no tolerance for hot dogging and buzzing? What would permit people to begin to think they could get by with that? I don't know the answers, and we don't even know if they're culpable.
Well, it's hard to believe when you hear about something like Commerce Secretary Ron Brown and his plane going down. Apparently, that was an accident that could have been avoided.
Not only an accident could have been avoided, but there was another accident investigation that was not only botched and covered up, but people weaseled around with it. Some of them got caught, some of them didn't. If the full story is ever really revealed to the American public on that accident investigation and the shucking and jiving that went on to try to shift blame and get some people with stars on their shoulders off the hot seat, we will probably have to recall a couple of senior officers to active duty so we can court-martial them, including the former chief of staff.
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Back in 1998, I talked to John J. Nance. We talked a lot about aviation, and we'll continue with that interview right after this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, revisiting an interview I did in 1998 with John J. Nance. And almost 30 years later, everything has changed so much in aviation, in computing. We didn't talk about artificial intelligence 30 years ago. We sure are talking about it now. Let's revisit those rather primitive days of computing for this final segment of our interview.
You've got a real high-tech element going in this book. Mm-hmm. I love the computer stuff going on in this book. Are you a computer nerd of sorts?
Well, not a computer nerd, no. I know my way around them, but I've never been able to program. And the one thing that is really important to me is that all my books have absolutely no Clancy-esque component to it in this way. You know, Tom Clancy has his own audience, and they love nuts and bolts. And he can go for 100 pages and talk about bolts and nuts and building a nuclear bomb. I don't do that. I talk about people on the stage of aviation. But the fun part is that in the background, when you look at that stage, you know, when your eyes wander from the actors over to the backdrop, what you see is aviation the way it really exists. And that's where it's important to get in the few details necessary to give you some insight as to a glass cockpit, for instance, or as to how the throttles actually did come up in a particular scene in which you really do need to know that. One thing that writers make a mistake on when they try to poke their nose into aviation, and I haven't read Crichton's book, where he stuck his nose under my tent, but I don't know if he did this or not, but many of them who get into aviation, try to put an aviation scene, they get enamored of what they see on research, and they try to over-describe the cockpit, over-describe all this. It's not necessary. We all know what a cockpit is, even if you can't even find an airport without help. So I have enough in there to satisfy all my friends in the business. And believe me, they'll tell me in a nanosecond if I get anything wrong. But for the average reader, and I've got about 55-60% of my readership is female, and I'm very proud of that, they don't have to wade through any technology or technocracy. They don't want to hear about it. It doesn't get in the way. It's the people and the relationships and the high-speed story. In this case, in a moving aluminum tube that makes it work. John Grisham uses the stage of Southern Law. I use a moving aluminum tube.
It was my pleasure a couple of years ago to have Buzz Aldrin on this program. Buzz came from a family where his dad was an aviation pioneer. It sounds like your stepfather might have been an inspiration for you.
I lost my father in 1977. He was a senior attorney, and he was definitely an inspiration. He had been an Air Force pilot, B-25s, B-17s, B-29s, and in the reserves. Never a private pilot. He gave it up kind of in the 50s. I guess it was more frosting on the cake when my mother remarried years later. This gentleman was a retired two-star Air Force general. Just an incredible individual, General Edmund C. Lynch, a West Point graduate. He'd been there in the brown shoe days, as we used to state it. And he wrote a book called Memories of an Early Bird that circulating around fairly well over the years. Wonderful guy, unflappable. I knew a couple of airline captains like this. If you came up and said, Captain, the left wing is on fire, half the right wing has fallen off, and the tail is getting very jittery, he would have said, hey, it's interesting. Give me another cup of coffee, and Jim, let's run the checklist on that. Totally unflappable people. And I had just infinite respect for him. He died at the age of 91.
That's quite a cool to have, to be able to react that way.
Definitely.
My guest is John J. Nance, and his new book is The Last Hostage. And we don't want to give away too much about the plot, but you definitely take the reader on some twists and turns there. What is your writing style? Do you take a long time? Do you do a lot of editing? Are you an early morning person? What do you do?
Well, first of all, I'd love to claim that every day at 5:30 I get up and, yeah, that's bull. I'd be able to sustain that. First of all, my wife, who's here with me on the tour, would fall on the floor laughing and you'd hear it. I sometimes get up at 11 o'clock in the morning, sometimes at 5:30 in the morning. I really would like to write more in the morning because I do a better job. I try to get 10 to 12 pages done a day. I usually achieve an overall book average of 8.5 to 8.7 a day. That's 1.5 spacing and normal 1-inch parameters on the page. I use a word processor. I am very, very diligent about getting the product out in that way on a steady march, but I may be writing the midnight or 1 a.m. too. As far as my style, it's third person. I'm the voice hanging in the sky, so to speak. I've looked at John Grisham's use of first person and others. I find it very restrictive, and I just don't think I'll ever do that, although never say never. I like very much to anchor my story in a linear fashion in date and time and place, because I have had a real bone in my throat as a reader when an author jumps around so much that I have to go back and try to graph out where he is. Am I forward? Am I backward? When is this? So I give you datelines and times and let you very clearly see the march of the story. And I try not ever to do a flashback. If it's a flashback at all, it's an over-the-shoulder running thing and you never lose real time. And the other thing is, what I'm trying to do is take the reader on a wild ride. I'm not trying to make any statements. I'm not trying to get on a forum. There are second, third, and fourth levels to the book if you want to peel those back. But first and foremost, you should be able to open it to page one, zip all the way to page 4, 30 or 20, whatever this one is, maybe a 380, and never have much more time than to take in a breath or two and get a glass of water. Never want to put it down and feel at the end somewhat exhilarated and that it was a really wonderful ride and you want to do it again. And more important than anything else, that you want to hear more about these characters. If I can't get you to care about these people in the first page or two, I haven't done my job. And on this one, I've got some real good people. I got to tell you about Kat Bronski. I love this girl. I created her out of whole cloth. She's an FBI agent. She's young. She's in her 20s. She's just gotten out of Quantico after a training course. She kind of pushed to get it in hostage negotiation because she's also a psychologist. And she gets pulled into this thing, her first hostage negotiation assignment. And at first, she's just wildly excited until she realizes, my God, if I make a mistake, I could kill a bunch of people here. But this lady has a refined ability to think for herself. She's not a maverick to the extent that she won't regard regulations as something she needs to follow, but she will think for herself. And she ends up all through this book thinking for herself, angering all her male colleagues in the male-dominated FBI who just know she's going to fail, but actually ends up doing some incredible things just because of that trait. She's a strong female. She does not need a male to define her. There are no boyfriends or no husbands. There's nothing in here needed to define her as a strong person any more than I would have to put a female to define a male. I'm very proud of my women characters, and Kat is so good, and I'm so happy with her that I'm going to bring her back in the next book.
The Attorney General's an interesting guy, too. You have a lot of fun with him, I can tell.
I do. I learned a good lesson on my first novel. In my first draft of my first novel, Final Approach, was a chief pilot who was without redeeming value on this planet, the first draft. Now, he changed by the time we actually got the book written. But my editor wrote me back at one point and said, good grief, back off. He said, you know, everybody's got a little redeeming value. And I took a look at this guy, and I had vented some spleen in putting him together. Ever since then, I've been much more careful to always, always bring the human dimensions in. There are very few purely evil people on this planet. And some of them, fortunately, we've gotten rid of, like Ted Bundy. There are a few, but most people always have a multifaceted element to them, that even when a lot of bad is in them, there's still some good. There is still something to explain, if not ameliorate. And that's the case here. You've got an individual who is not necessarily as bad as he at first seems, but I take you on a pretty good ride because you don't know whether he's good, he's bad, he's ugly, he's in between. Neither does Ken Wolfe, the captain. And it's that interplay and that psychological battle that goes on between these two men, one trained in a completely different world of law and dissembling and advocacy, and the other trained in a very black and white world of the gear is up or the gear is down. It shouldn't be anywhere in between. The switch is on, the switch is off. And yet they're battling for their lives. Both of them are, really. And Kat walks into the middle of this, gets sucked into the middle of this, and has to force both of them to do things that they don't want to do in very life-changing ways. And that really, this is the most fun book I've written, because when I got this airplane over the ridgeline of the Wasatch Mountains and this psychological battle began, the words began to flow. They didn't write it for me, but I knew exactly what they would say, and it became a lot of fun to write.
Are we going to be seeing this one on television?
I never say it for sure until the film moves through the camera and the check clears the bank, but it is scheduled to be a two-part miniseries on ABC this fall, and we're too soon for casting. The script is being prepared by somebody else, a good screenwriter named Tom Cook, and, you know, at any day I expect to hear, no, ABC pulled the plug. We may go ahead, we may not. I think it has a very good chance. I would love to have this made into a feature film, but TV's been very good to me, and I want to continue for a while there.
You mentioned Ted Bundy a minute ago. He committed some crimes up in your neck of the woods. Have you ever heard of Earl Emerson?
I've heard of him. I couldn't tell you a lot about
him. He's an author.
He's a writer who I've met once, and he's done some very good work in ferreting out things very much like Ann Rule. Annie Rule's a friend of ours who lives in the Puget Sound region as well. And, boy, you talk about an author who's earned her stripes. I tell you, I haven't gone through anything like what Anne went through. I mean, she is very worthy of a good, solid, supportive audience. She really paid her dues, writing for penny magazines and so on, and it puts out an excellent product, too.
Anne Rule. Earl Emerson was here a couple, 3 years ago with a book, and Ted Bundy was one of his neighbors, and he remembered him, and Earl's wife fit the profile of women that Ted Bundy was attracted to. And it was one of those, if not for the grace of God, there go I sort of things that he actually, he remembered Ted Bundy and having conversations with him in the neighborhood.
That is very, very frightening.
Very eerie.
Ann Rule worked with him, but she has made the point over and over again that she was as safe as if she'd been in her mother's arms.
She worked with Bundy, Ted?
Yeah, because Bundy never killed the people that he worked with and who knew him well, because that was part of his facade and the sociopathic facade that he had out there. But somebody down the street would have been easily a different situation. I didn't know Earl had had that experience.
Who are some of the writers that you admire?
Oh, well, first and foremost is James Michener. Changed my life, changed my career, probably made the career. I read Hawaii. I went to the University of Hawaii for a year, direct result of that book. I read Centennial. It completely changed my view of how a writer thinks and what a writer should do. Here's an area of the world, northeastern Colorado, I'd been traveling through for years to get to the mountains, thought it was worthless. After I got through reading his book, I practically wanted to move there. And as he said, I got to spend a day with him many years ago in Sitka, Alaska. I did the usual thing. I arrived with 8 books for him to sign. But at any rate, he said to me, you know, one of my greatest prides is taking the ordinary and making it extraordinary simply through the structuring of the English language. He will be missed, I think, a lot more in the future than he is now. I think Jim redefined a whole genre, and on top of that, he redefined what it is to entertain and educate at the same time with the written word. And he had one thing he was also very proud of. I remember him telling me, was that none of his books had ever been out of print. First time I had one go out of print, I thought, well, okay, I've blown it. And then I realized, he told me later, no, only fiction. So far I'm okay. I'd say also people like Pat Conroy. Beautiful use of the language. I wish I could utilize a style like that, but a thriller, a high-speed thriller, simply will not give you time to do that. Ken Follett came up with probably the best intro to a book I have ever read. I mean, one that's just absolutely marvelous. The Key to Rebecca, the first line, "The last camel died at noon." You can't put that down. That's perfect. So, you know, I have my favorites, too. But it begins with Jim Michener, and then it goes on from there.
Pat Conroy sat right where you're sitting.
Is that right? I've never met Pat. I'm really looking forward to it.
He's quite a guy. James Michener really had a talent for totally immersing himself in the subject matter.
Yeah, absolutely. And learning everything he could about it to the point that the people that he painted in were the embodiment of a type of individual. It didn't have to be that individual or that family, who was very representative of the period and the ethos of what it was he was trying to get across. Whether it was the Chinese immigrants into Hawaii, or whether it was the folks who came west on the wagon train and first decided to put crops out rather than continue on west in Centennial, and you know, on and on. Chesapeake had its examples. Texas did. Alaska did. You know, he takes a lot of grief to this day, and I'm sure will for a long time, of having started out with a geological history. But tell me, anybody who's read any of those books, didn't you learn something? And geophysically speaking, we all are a little bit challenged and need to know more about that. So I think that even those first chapters that start out with the formation of the first volcanic activity that laid the plain, that, you know, et cetera, et cetera, I think all that was well worth it. He had his style. I'll never copy that, although I would love to do a multi-generational book someday.
This is a man who started life as an orphan.
Yeah.
And really went a long way. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I believe his wife attended Antioch here in Yellow Springs.
You know, I'd forgotten that, but I think you are right. Uh-huh. I couldn't guarantee it. What also amazed me was he didn't start writing until age 43. Very, very late into this. That was another thing. I was grousing around to him up there about where I was in the writing spectrum at that particular time. And he said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "How old are you?" And I told him I was in the 30s at the time. He says, "I didn't start till I was 43. He said, "You haven't even begun." Hmm. Very inspirational guy.
Do you have any last words, perhaps, to tantalize our listeners into becoming readers of your new book?
Well, just this. You know how you felt when you first read The Firm? that kind of new excitement in a book that was very linear and extremely engaging. And there were elements to it that that John Echo, John Grisham, and his next two. Well, give me a try. Not to displace John. Buy his stuff too, because he's a great writer. But this is what I do too. Don't get hung up on the airplanes. This is good human high-speed fiction. And I really worry sometimes that people may think that The Airplane on the Front means it's a nuts and bolts book or a boy book, and it's nothing like that. But I guarantee you, you'll enjoy it. And I've made this blanket statement, but if anybody really hates the book, write me. I'll buy it back from you. It's not going to happen. We're doing very well, but I really want to expand my readership, not just for the monetary purpose, but I really enjoy doing this, and I enjoy the feedback I get, especially when somebody says, "Damn it, Nance, you kept me up to 4 a.m. in the morning." I love to hear that.
Well, I'm in that group, John, and I found it to be a very enjoyable read, and you took me down some nice twists and turns with the plot.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been John J. Nance. The book is The Last Hostage.
Those were the days. Revisiting an interview I did with John J. Nance back in 1998. He published his last book in 2017. He was a best-selling author. I Googled him. He's been involved in some documentary filmmaking in Canada, I see, in recent years, but I think the best-selling books have all been published from him. I think he's living a happy retirement in the Seattle area. And during our conversation, he brought up Ted Bundy, and he mentioned that he knew Ann Rule. Now, Ann Rule was another best-selling author who died a number of years ago. She is from the Seattle area, and when he was on the show, I had never interviewed Ann Rule, but I did an interview with her after that, and she came in, and we were talking, and she talked about how she had worked with Ted Bundy. And during that conversation with John Nance, he mentioned how Ted Bundy wouldn't target people who he worked with, but he had a certain type of person that he liked to murder. And Ann Rule's daughter apparently fit that profile. And it was so creepy to interview the late Ann Rule and hear what it was like to work with a guy she didn't know was a serial killer. Ooh. Tune in tomorrow when we'll revisit an interview I did with a best-selling romance writer, Julie Garwood. She has sold over 40 million books. She died a few years ago. She was from Kansas City, and we had a great time talking about her very first contemporary romance novel. That's tomorrow at 10:30. In the Book Nook, the best of the Book Nook tomorrow, right here on your public radio station. Thanks for tuning in.